because I'm old, using an older.
Page 324.
Okay, good. So, where we were, to back up a little bit, this chapter, Indeterminates and Cosmic Determinations, Sri Aurobindo looks at the problem of knowledge as something which faces us with a mystery. The cosmos faces us with a mystery. And there is a cosmic mystery and an absolute mystery there. The cosmic mystery comes from the fact that, to use the term of Heidegger, we find ourselves thrown into this universe without a proper understanding of what the substance into which we are thrown and the process into which we are thrown is all about. So, once we try to figure it out, our focus naturally first moves towards the functional aspects of understanding. How can we survive in this universe? But to whatever extent we can understand the mechanism of the cosmos, ultimate mysteries elude us. We don't know from where this cosmos came and from where we came and if or what the meaning of this cosmos is. What is it here for? And what is the origin? So that's the problem that he takes up, and he deals with the two primary faces or presentations through which our mind receives this cosmos. One is that of a determinant cosmos, something which can be understood in terms of laws, in terms of a logic, and something which cannot be so understood and which seems to be random. And both these explanations seem to exist side by side. To some extent, it seems as if certain things are accidental and certain things are ordered, driven by necessity. And to some extent, it seems as if all is random. And then some people have made a case for everything to be ordered. So these are certain views through which we receive the universe, and they can become like faiths. It's like a working faith with which we take the universe. So here Sri Aurobindo is proposing a hypothesis with which he begins, which is that of a intelligent cosmos, in the sense that there is only one single conscious being, that is all there is, which is the Brahman in the Vedantic terminology. And this has become the cosmos. So when we say it has become the cosmos, as we saw, he is avoiding or going away from the duality of the creator and the creation, and saying that what we call the creation is in fact the creator. So the creator is completely involved in the creation. Neither is the creator transcendental, in the sense that he remains outside and guides it from outside, nor is he a transcendental within the immanent. In other words, remains inside but separated from the constituents of the cosmos. But he is an immanent, absolute immanent. In other words, has completely become the entire cosmos and all the elements in it. Now, this does not mean that he has or it has left its transcendental poise to become this, or that it does not exist as a transcendental within the immanent. All these possibilities coexist, and in a sense, this becoming cosmos of the conscious being is not an event in time. And that is a very important point, because it isn't something that began at a certain point and will end at a certain point. It is, as Sri Aurobindo paradoxically calls it in certain places, an event in eternity. An event in eternity is another way of saying that it is a condition of consciousness, without beginning and end, but a condition which inaugurates time, or which is expressed in the key of time. It is time as being. That is the nature of this kind of condition of consciousness, in which there is a perpetual involution evolution that is going on. So that is the nature of the hypothesis that he proposes. And then he says, how can we test this hypothesis? And if it is conscious, if it is a conscious being we are talking about, then indeed we can try to use our own consciousness to test it. Now, so far, we may say that Sri Aurobindo is following a line of reasoning that can have its counterpart in the Western Enlightenment tradition. The Western Enlightenment tradition also follows a line of reasoning in which it probes the world through a form of consciousness. But as we know with Descartes, that form of consciousness stops with the mind. It says the fact that we can think is the root of being. It is as if consciousness is present as thought. And that's the way in which we normally understand the word consciousness. Now, what Sri Aurobindo is talking about, however, is a consciousness that includes thought, or of which thought is a modality, but which far transcends thought and includes everything, including the body, including matter, including the life energies, including the mind, including things beyond the mind, and aspects of the mind beyond our present spectrum of mind. So this range of consciousness is something which Sri Aurobindo is talking about as present, ever present, in this involution evolution process, dynamic. So he's saying, to probe this, we must use consciousness, but if we try to use consciousness at the level of involution, so we try to find something asleep within the cosmos, like a latent supermind, it is almost impossible to reach it, because it is covered over by the obscurity of matter. It is asleep within matter. And whatever consciousness we may have within matter is not sufficient because of the dense sleep. In other words, these ranges of consciousness, like matter, life, and even mind to its own extent, are much more determined, and this determination is occurring through a certain self-presentation which is being called in the Vedantic sense Prakriti. So this nature of Prakriti, from which consciousness cannot extract itself to observe it, is the problematic element because of which we cannot access this involved root of consciousness within the cosmos. So he says, where are we to find it? Is it at all possible to find it. And he's saying, let us look at the upper ranges, the ranges of mind. And so he's taking us out of that particular process of ratiocination into the yoga tradition of yoga, and pointing to the possibility of quieting the mind, because mind, after all, what we call thought, is also a process. So he's saying, if we are to look at, observe consciousness, arrive at consciousness in its purity, it must be something that is not driven by process. It must be something that can emerge from the becoming and know itself as free from the becoming. And so that is possible at the level of mind. And that is what yogis have done when they put the mind to sleep, or put the mind to rest, and emerge as what has been called the Purusha, the witness self. So this witness self is something that Sri Aurobindo begins with, but he says that yes, it is possible to look at the witness, look at the operations of the mind through the witness self, but we find that we are unsure as to whether this is a personal experience we are having or whether this is a cosmic experience, because after all it is our own mind, and the mind is one mind within the cosmos. Moreover, the processes of mind that are being observed can be seen to exist independently from the observer. So where did they come from? And the observer, is he only one observer among many, or is he in some way connected to a universal or cosmic observer? So that's where we are presently, and Sri Aurobindo has said that we have to try to arrive at a higher and more cosmic consciousness from which we find a better vantage to this question. And the paragraph before the one in which we are at present attempts that. It's the paragraph that begins, "Overmind consciousness is such a state or principle beyond individual mind."
Go ahead. Sorry
about that. Yeah. So, but there he ends that paragraph by talking about the same kind of thing. And he talks about three views of creation that arise from this particular experience of the overmind consciousness. So there he's saying that there too we find that there is a cosmic witness, but the processes that go on within this overmind are also independent of the cosmic witness. He is not the originator of those processes. So I read that part where he's saying, "The original question set out for us by the phenomenon of the universe is not solved by the overmind knowledge. The question in this case, whether the building of thought, experience, world of perceptions of the mental person, the mind Purusha, is truly a self-expression, a self-determination proceeding from some truth of his own spiritual being, a manifestation of that truth's dynamic possibilities, or whether it is not rather a creation or construction presented to him by nature, by Prakriti, and only in the sense of being individualized in his personal formation of that nature, can it be said to be his own or dependent on him. Or again, it might be a play of a cosmic imagination, a fantasia of the infinite, imposed on the blank indeterminable of his own eternal pure existence." So these are the three views, and we discussed this a little bit last time. One view being that the individual is producing these processes from some secret depth of his own being. The other one being that a cosmic nature, a prakriti, is producing these things and presenting them for the observation of consciousness. So that is the traditional Sankhya position. And then the third one is that some cosmic being has actually produced through its imagination, external to its reality, the processes of cosmos, projection of the processes of cosmos. So that's where we stand right now, and we can continue from the paragraph that was read last time, in overmind, all the higher ranges of mind, etc.
Devajita,
yeah.
So talking of those three positions, in the last one where you said talked about the projection, where the external entity has projected out this consciousness for others to observe, in that case, who is the person who is observing? Is it the individual consciousness of all of us, or?
Yeah, the mental Purusha.
Okay.
The mental Purusha is observing. So as he says, whether that third one is might be a play of a cosmic imagination, a fantasia of the infinite imposed on the blank indeterminable of his own eternal pure existence. So we are observing through the mental Purusha, but even the cosmic Purusha is observing something which has been thrust upon its screen, as it were, out of some blind sort of unconscious process within itself. And actually Sri Aurobindo is going to question this, because he says that this is a very obscure kind of possibility. This in fact is the Shankarite possibility. This possibility is the Advaitic position, where they are saying that Maya is that cosmic magician that is projecting a fantasy in Brahman. So it is an illusion, and Brahman alone is true, this world is false. That's the position they take. But he's going to point out that that is not really a monistic, idea, but a dualistic idea. If such a process, unconscious process, exists, it cannot but be a process of Brahman itself. This is the point that he'll make.
Thank you, Devashisna. So we'll start reading. It's on page 324 in my book. It starts with the paragraph. The paragraph starts with "In overmind, in all the higher ranges." Dan Wood, would you like to read? John Robert?
I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah.
Can you hear me?
Now we can.
Oh, okay. In overmind, in all the higher ranges of the mind, we find recurring the dichotomy of a pure silent self without feature or qualities or relations, self-existent, self-poised, self-sufficient, and the mighty dynamis of a determinative knowledge power, of a creative consciousness and force which precipitates itself into the forms of the universe. This opposition, which is yet a collection, as if these two were correlatives or complementaries, although apparent contradictions of each other, sublimates itself into the coexistence of an impersonal Brahman, without qualities, a fundamental divine reality free from all relations or determinants, and a Brahman with infinite qualities, a fundamental divine reality who is the source and container and master of all relations and determinations. Nirguna Saguna. If we pursue the Nirguna into a farthest possible self-experience, we arrive at a supreme absolute void of all relations and determinations, the ineffable first and last word of existence. If we enter through the saguna into some ultimate possible of experience, we arrive at a divine absolute, a personal supreme and omnipresent Godhead, transcendent as well as universal, an infinite master of all relations and determinations, who can uphold in his being a million universes and pervade each with a single ray of his self-light and a single degree of his ineffable existence. The overmind consciousness maintains equally these two truths of the eternal, which face the mind as mutually exclusive alternatives. It admits both as supreme aspects of one reality. Somewhere, then, behind them, there must be a still greater transcendence, which originates them or holds them both in its supreme eternity. But what can that be of which such opposites are equal truths, unless it be an original, indeterminable mystery of which any knowledge, any understanding by the mind is impossible? We can know it indeed to some degree, in some kind of experience or realization, by its aspects, powers, constant series of fundamental negatives and positives through which we have to pursue it, independently in either or integrally in both together. But in the last resort, it seems to escape even from the highest mentality and remain unknowable. You want me to continue?
No, I think you can stop there. And somebody has the mic on. So here he is telling us that the duality that we encountered persists here as well. We still have this duality of the cosmos as a pure cosmic being, free of all operations, that can withdraw into itself and ultimately become a void. In other words, we can club the two positions of Advaita Vedanta and Buddhism into this. And on the other hand, that can take on this all-inclusive aspect of the Lord of the Cosmos, a personal and theistic approach upholding everything. So these are the two, the infinite all and the solitary unique absolute. And these two seem to have equal validity at the level of overmind. Now, he will also point out that at this level of overmind, there will be a number of other ideas into which these can further resolve themselves, which also each have equal right of existence and representation of the absolute. Now, one of the things about this entire scenario as he has presented it up until now is this ultimate duality that pursues us. And so that's why he's saying at this point there must be something even beyond that cosmic peak called the overmind, where this duality disappears. Now, this is, of course, assuming that there is a ultimate one, that we are dealing with a monism that resolves all dualities, and there is meaning to the cosmos. Now, it's interesting if we look at this question of duality from the Western standpoint. We find that a similar kind of problem has been grappled with by the thinkers of the Enlightenment, particularly by Kant. Kant notices this fact that there is a certain duality, and that we as human beings, as knowers, as people who can acquire knowledge, can hence separate ourselves from our objects of knowledge, and ultimately separate ourselves from ourselves as objects of knowledge. So this separation can take place in mind. So we can see that there is a certain parallel activity of the Purusha within the mind, and that is exactly why the notion of intelligence, buddhi, as a pure divine faculty has occupied the Western philosophers so much. It seems to be that power by which we can observe and think out the laws of the universe. They equate it with the Logos being a divine rationality, a divine ordering principle. So, if there is such a thing, yet Kant was the one who began seeing its limitations, and that is what his entire critique of pure reason is all about, or largely about. The fact that this particular ability to observe the cosmos and to make available knowledge to ourselves of the cosmos is yet constrained by the laws of the cosmos. See, in other words, he was to point out, if we translate this intuition into the terms of the Indian philosophers, that intellect is either a part of Prakriti, buddhi is either a part of Prakriti or closely tied to Prakriti. So, in the Sankhya conception, we can take this one step further and say Purusha is separate from Prakriti, or can separate itself completely from Prakriti, but yet is closely tied to Prakriti. They are codependent. This is one of the points that he's making over here. And this point in the Western system comes to its more recent critiques in the thoughts of people like Michel Foucault, who terms this, you know, paradoxical existence of consciousness in the human as a empirico-transcendental doublet. An empirico-transcendental doublet. And by that he means that we are partly transcendental and partly empirical. We become the objects of our own empirical study, and we have a part of ourselves that transcends and tries to provide the conditions under which we can know this empirical part. We are the knowers of ourselves as objects of knowledge. Now, this paradox, of course, is something which is very problematic, and even in his own time, Kant understood this, but he could not resolve it. The reason he couldn't resolve it is that he does propose a certain other kind of knowledge, a knowledge that can be called the knowledge of God, which is immediate and direct and does not have this duality within it. It is a knowledge by identity. He calls it the intuitivus originarius, the original intuition. And it is by that intuition that God knows immediately anything, not because it presents itself in a certain way, and whatever freedom that particular knower may have is contingent upon that which presents itself, as it is in our case. It's like saying we can find a vantage of freedom to who we are, but that vantage of freedom is tied to who we are. Freedom from what? Freedom from our nature. So it's always tied to the nature. It is not an absolute freedom. But an absolute freedom would traverse nature instantaneously. And that is the whole notion of God knowledge. Now here is where Sri Aurobindo is converging with that thought, yet pushing it further in saying that that's the kind of consciousness that we seek. Up until Overmind, this empirico-transcendental doublet pursues us. But there is that originarius, intuitus originarius, which we can look for. And then he's asking this question, is that something which is so absolute that all formulations disappear because it is indeterminate? Now, this question is again a very profound philosophical question, because radical infinity cannot be ordered. In other words, if it is so radical that it is absolutely infinite, it is indeterminable, just like the Vedanta calls it the unknowable. If it is truly unknowable, then all knowables that proceed from forms of ordering are secondary to it. They are not primary and can be thought of as illusions. This is the reason why if there is something beyond, most of the Indian traditions have thought that there is an approach to it, but it is like sinking into an ocean. It's like the metaphor given in the Upanishads of the salt doll trying to plumb the ocean. As soon as it enters, it dissolves. So we end up with two ways of looking at it. One is the Kantian Enlightenment method, which says that it's impossible to arrive at it because it is outside of the ceiling or horizon that is provided to the human. In other words, the human is already predetermined and given a certain ceiling, and we cannot go beyond that. That is still related to the creator-creation duality. And on the other hand, you have the entire Vedantic tradition that has privileged over history the notion that we cannot know it in any way that can be formulated, since as soon as we try to know it, we sink in it, like the salt doll that gets dissolved in the ocean as soon as it enters it. That's the point where we are right now. Another contemporary philosopher, this is Gilles Deleuze, who I've spoken about earlier, approaches this problem of radical infinity, calling it the plane of immanence, because he's saying nothing is outside of it, everything is inside it, it is the absolute immanent. But being radically infinite, it cannot be ordered. It's beyond every possibility of ordering. So that is the nature of this plane of immanence. But then he says that nevertheless it can present itself to itself. And if it can present itself to itself, that means that there is a certain formulation by which it can know itself. In other words, the possibility of self-knowledge is also part of its own infinity. And that is what he calls the plane of consistence. And human reasoning is like a little fragment out of that plane of consistence. Now, similarly, Sri Aurobindo will say that exactly in that manner, that absolute infinity has its own way of knowing itself, and that is supermind. And supermind also has a subsidiary and finite action, which is the way in which we know, our property of knowledge.
Margaret Frains, would you like to read next?
I'm here, just one second. We're at but if, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
But if the Supreme Absolute is indeed a pure indeterminable, then no creation, no manifestation, no universe is possible. And yet the universe exists. What then is it that creates this contradiction, is able to affect the impossible, bring this insoluble riddle of self-division into existence? A power of some kind it must be. And since the Absolute is the sole reality, the one origin of all things, this power must proceed from it, must have some relation with it, a connection, a dependence. For if it is quite other than the supreme reality, a cosmic imagination imposing its determinations on the eternal blank of the indeterminable, then the sole existence of an absolute Parabrahman is no longer admissible. There is then a dualism at the source of things, not substantially different from the Sankhya dualism of soul and nature. If it is a power, the sole power indeed of the Absolute, we have this logical impossibility that the existence of the Supreme Being and the power of his existence are entirely opposite to each other, to supreme contradictions. For Brahman is free from all possibility of relations and determinations. But Maya is a creative imagination imposing these very things upon it, an originator of relations and determinations of which Brahman must necessarily be the supporter and witness to the logical reason, an inadmissible formula. If it is accepted, it can only be as a supra-rational mystery, something neither real nor unreal, inexplicable in its nature. Arne Vakan, yeah. But the difficulties are so great that it can be accepted only if it imposes itself irresistibly as the inevitable ultimate, the end and summit of metaphysical inquiry and spiritual experience. For even if all things are illusory creations, they must have at least a subjective existence, and they can exist nowhere except in the consciousness of this existence. They are then subjective determinations of the indeterminable. If, on the contrary, the determinations of this power are real creations, out of what are they determined? What is their substance? It is not possible that they are made out of nothing, a non-existence other than the Absolute. For that will erect a new dualism, a great positive zero, over against the greater indeterminable X we have supposed to be the one reality. It is evident, therefore, that the reality cannot be a rigid indeterminable. Whatever is created must be of and in it, and what is of the substance of the utterly real must itself be real. A vast, baseless negation of reality purporting to be real cannot be the sole outcome of the eternal truth, the infinite existence. It is perfectly understandable that the Absolute is and must be indeterminable in the sense that it cannot be limited by any determination or any sum of possible determinations, but not in the sense that it is incapable of self-determination. The supreme existence cannot be incapable of creating true self-determinations of its being, incapable of upholding a real self-creation or manifestation in its self-existent infinite.
So that is what we were talking about, in the sense that there is a almost like an assumption here, as he says, that the assumption of the absolute Parabrahman as a single monistic conscious being, that there is nothing other than that, is at the basis of this entire thinking through. And what he's pointing out is the fact that if that is the case, then there cannot be a duality, an absolute duality, that stands outside of it. See, so that's the reason why he points out that this supreme being and the power of his existence cannot be entirely opposed. If there is such a duality, there must be something beyond that duality which unites them or gives them a certain form of union. And that's the point that he's making, in that though it is ultimately indeterminable, yet it can determine itself. In other words, there is a certain way by which it can look at itself. This is not logically finite, because that's the problem of the Purusha Prakriti dichotomy that we have encountered so far, that every Purusha is tied to a certain empirical finite, so that even if it is a transcendental, it is a transcendental finite, because it is connected to an empirical finite. But if there is a transcendental infinite, then there must be another mode of its self, you know, representation or self-presentation, which proceeds from its self-knowledge. How does it perceive itself? This is ultimately, it goes back to one of Sri Aurobindo's famous aphorisms, pithy aphorisms, regarding his own project, where he says that, "I do not wish to know God as man may know God, but as God may know himself." And all that we have known so far, and the limitations of what I've talked about with regard to people like Kant, etc., is man trying to know God, and man erecting certain limitations on God based on his own limitations. If we have a ceiling that separates us absolutely from God, then we can only know God as man knows God. Or else, if we can approach God but not know God's own self-knowledge, or assume that there cannot be such a self-knowledge, then all that we can do is plunge into that ocean and get dissolved. But what Sri Aurobindo is saying is, since knowledge exists, and since there is ordering in the universe, categories by which reality may be known, since there is determination in the universe, there must be a way by which the absolute indeterminable can view itself, and that self-viewing is its absolute self-determination. It's a modality which is not finite as the transcendental finite, but transcendentally infinite, and hence incomprehensible to mind, but nevertheless comprehensible to itself. That is the nature of supermind. And that's the reason why he's pointing to this, you know, this organ of God, if you might call it that, that we must arrive at an identity with. This identity with the supermind is that which will give us that particular complete grasp of the cosmos or cosmic reality beyond all dualities. Without wiping the cosmos out of existence in a disordered or unordered ocean of Satchidananda. Now, this is a very profound point, and that's really why Sri Aurobindo's philosophy hinges around this point. It may be said that the Western traditions have been in search for this kind of a, you know, a son of knowledge that they have given the name Logos to, and even earlier Gnosis. And the Eastern traditions, but nevertheless, they have restricted the idea of the Logos and the Gnosis by the properties of human knowledge. And that's the reason we have not been able to arrive at a true understanding. Kant critiques that and points out the limitations of human reason, but nevertheless builds a wall where he says that we cannot arrive at that Logos or Gnosis because it is infinitely beyond us. The Eastern tradition, on the other hand, has completely negated the Logos. It is as if the Logos does not exist, and either you have the illusion of a knowledge system, a determinable creation, or a leap into an ocean without any order. So it's between these two, Sri Aurobindo is positing something which he says can be known because consciousness can rise into that consciousness and know it since it has originated from there. That which is in mind has been projected by supermind, and there isn't a unbridgeable gap between the two. It is possible to move into supermind, have identity with it, and know its modality of self-knowledge, which is a different modality than that of the human, what one might call a transcendental infinite knowledge.
This, you know, unknowable, that, this part, I was thinking, I mean, if we think of, as Mother says, that God alone exists. So, if everything, is God, so then it is just, could be a matter of partial and whole, knowability, like whether we can know the whole or we can know a little part of it. Does it make sense?
Indeed, well, what it is that knowing whole or part, what we know at this point are parts. But God knows the whole. So if we can move into that knowledge by which God knows himself, then we know the whole and the part. In fact, knowing the part and the whole is exactly the way in which Vedanta describes vidya and avidya. Avidya is the knowledge of the parts, and all the parts can be known and even pieced together, but still we won't have the knowledge of the whole. Then vidya is the knowledge of the whole. Now, the knowledge of the whole can be actually a knowledge without any content. In other words, that's the knowledge where the self-knowledge of God is a knowledge by identity of its own transcendental reality, turned upon itself, which loses the knowledge of the parts. It is only the knowledge of the whole without the knowledge of the parts. Self-evident knowledge of the whole. Or it could be a knowledge of the whole and the parts at the same time. In other words, how does the divine perceive its own infinity all at once? That kind of knowledge would be the knowledge of supermind.
Thank you.
could you explain once more how we are saying Sri Aurobindo is, you know, finding that that bridge between, like, you know, the approach to find that logos which Kant says we can't, and which the Eastern traditions that which says it doesn't exist.
Yeah, you're asking how he arrives at that? How are we to arrive at that?
Yes.
Is that your question? So he hasn't really got to that point as yet. He's saying that such a consciousness exists, and if we can arrive at a cosmic mind, which is the overmind, if we can arrive at overmind, and we pursue this duality further into its source, then there should be a source which is absolute and infinite, radically infinite, from which it comes. But then he's essentially reasoning out the possibility of existence of supermind. He's saying it must exist. And I think that's the point, because, I mean, this is what's very interesting. I mean, the whole thing about the logos and experience, you know, again, which is in a sense taking that whole transcendental empirical transcendental doublet up into supermind, that unless we actually think the possibilities, we can miss the possibilities. You see, if we never thought that this exists, or if we thought along the other line that says that it cannot exist, because if it is indeterminable and unknowable, then whatever we call determinable must be an illusion. If we take that line of thought, then that's the experience we will have. This is the interesting part of what Sri Aurobindo is saying, that what we call experience is not unmediated by thought. Thought prepares for us the experience that we'll have. And that's exactly why he's telling us so many things. He's preparing the grounds for which we will look for a certain kind of God. In other words, the God that knows himself, not the God that's sunk in his own unknowing.
So what you're saying towards the end, like what you're saying is that in a way we have to have some predilection for a certain line of experience before we have that. It's not something that just falls on you.
In a way, yes. Of course, that would be not totally true, because experience does fall on you unbidden as well. But the point is that even if it falls on you unbidden, there is a very good possibility that you will miss out from your formulation those things that you didn't want to see. It's the retention of transcendental experience is through its translation into finitude. From the radically infinite, as soon as we formulate it and present it to ourselves, we are already turning it into something finite. And so that's the reason why he's saying that we have to persist in seeking that kind of knowledge in its own source, not that something which we will translate into our own terms. And that's what happens, for example, where, you know, he has a chapter called The Triple Status of the Supermind, where he is pointing to the fact that people have had that experience, but they have not been able to retain any shape of the totality of that experience, because the furthest reach of their own self-formulation is the overmind. And so under overmind, you can split that experience into separate, ways of looking at it. Like he talked about the three ways of looking at the relation between Purusha and Prakriti. So those separate ways of looking, and you'll hold on to one of those and say, that is the truth. Now, if you did reason it out, then you'd be able to see that all three of them were present in that experience. So that's why even if whether reason experience comes to us unbidden, or whether we aim for a certain experience through thought, this this way of thinking out what it is that we are looking for allows us to retain the link between the absolute and the relative.
So how do you balance between, you know, having a certain openness to what will come versus having a certain intensity in a specific direction or in a specific line of quote-unquote thought?
So thought, in that sense, that as we are looking at it right now, prepares the ground for our goal at the level of mind. But of course, it's only an orientation. It is not the experience. So experience comes to us, and we have to be open to experience. But that's the thing, that the relationship between the two is such that this clarity of thought also becomes even more clear, and the aspiration becomes more detailed with the kinds of experiences we get. We also can select or decide whether an experience was really the goal or not. That's why some of these spiritual experiences are so overwhelming, that were it not clear to us what we are looking for, we could easily take something else for granted and then stop there. Say there could be nothing greater than that. And this has been the case with a lot of the whole history of mysticism in the world. But that's partly the reason why Sri Aurobindo lays so much emphasis on philosophy of this kind, in being able to orient us and prevent us from stopping short of what it is that we need to get to.
Thank you, Devashish. That's very useful.
I was while you were speaking, I was thinking that in this manner, that even our thoughts, even our mind, everything is coming from God, or everything is God rather, and this is a principle, mental principle that has been intended to be so, and we are experiencing that particular intention or that particular principle, and we have to be conscious that there is something which is behind this intention, and then look at it from there so that see it more coherently, like having a glance of all the rationality which will fit things together. So basically, as I understand, that this intensity is in this principle, and we don't have to lose it. We just have to, go to a greater consciousness that is behind, of which this principle, this thought principle, is a part.
Yes, so actually you're right. What Sri Aurobindo is saying is that there are a variety of ways of doing that, one of which is to put the mind to silence. So what he's saying is that if we were to make it into a pure aspiration, that there is a different kind of rationality, a rationality of the infinite, which our kind of reasoning or our kind of consciousness, even the highest consciousness possible to us as mental beings, derives from that, but also hides that, you see, because it is not necessarily possible to move from this directly to that, because it hides it by its modality. It's a certain change of modality that has occurred. So if we accept that, then one possibility would be to retain a pure aspiration for the origin of this while putting this to silence. So that is one approach, the approach that he took himself by silencing the mind completely and looking for the logos beyond the mind. But what you're saying is also one of the, you know, possibilities he raises. If we look at the chapter called The Intuitive Mind in the Synthesis of Yoga, that's the fourth possibility of arriving at the logos, which is by retaining the intensity that is already within thought and heightening it, going through its own principle to that which is beyond it. Thought leads into its own origin. He says that is possible. And that is the kind of sort of process that he hints at in that particular chapter.
Thank you so much.
So, Devashish, this is John Robert. Would you comment a little bit about the relationship between this necessity, or at least usefulness, to be able to think the solution so that we'll notice it on the one hand, and the quality of equality that Sri Aurobindo emphasizes so much? I think you're touching on it when you're talking about the Sri Aurobindo's approach with the silence of the mind to kind of get beyond the human mind.
So, yes, I think equality, of course, is a primary thing. As he points out from the Gita, the line in the Gita says that equality is the very name of yoga. Samatvam yoga uchyate. Samatvam, equality. Yoga can be called as equality. So, here this ability to think the possibility of experience, what kind of experience we should have, I don't think it stands against equality in any way. In fact, that's also an aspect of equality, because to think all kinds of thoughts, all the various possibilities of thoughts, that's exactly what he's doing over here. He is mapping out all the possibilities that may be taken in each branch of that philosophical tree, and showing how all of them must be experienced at once for that particular experience that he's seeking. So that kind of, total seeing abrogates narrowness, but it also contains an intensity towards that. So I think that's the way in which you can approach, whether through thought or through the silencing of thought, both ways requires perfect equality, I think.
I think Mother speaks about these two terms as meditation and concentration. So could that be the terms that are related to these two aspects we are talking about?
Yeah, Mother talks about meditation and aspiration. I'm sorry, concentration. And meditation over there, I think that's a very good point. Because meditation, as Mother describes it, is a kind of complete equality. It's a kind of holding a totally neutral space, a space without any focus, a complete, infinite equality. And concentration is a focus, focus on something, one-pointed focus on something, whether an idea or something beyond it. And perhaps we may say that both these coexist in this kind of an approach.
To pursue this idea a little bit further, you were talking about the the different ways in which the East and the West have approached this, with the West using the mental knowledge and coming to the limit of human mental knowledge, and the East using the yogic methods to experience the infinite and then just dissolving in it. It seems like equality is a way of not being overwhelmed and dissolved, perhaps. So on that side, it looks like equality works that way. On the side of the mental knowledge and the mental thinking, does equality then provide like a clarity, like a kind of a base of clarity or an atmosphere of clarity in which the thinking can reach all of these different positions that Sri Aurobindo is able to hold when he's working this way?
Yeah, I think, John Robert, I think I agree. I think that's exactly looked at from both sides, probably equality is the merging point of the two. Because looked at from the point of view of the thoughts, as we can see, I mean, in this text itself, the kind of clear, almost supra-rational equality that holds all these thoughts in their various relations and forms, you know, and I think that's part of the very nature of this gnosis or logos. The logos exists in that consciousness of perfect equality. So whether we look at the divine consciousness and see, you know, I mean, to translate, for example, in Deleuze's terms, how can the plane of immanence be the plane of consistency? It can be so through that perfect equality of consciousness, which is the fundamental property of existence. Pure existence is marked by equality.
Thank you.
So this equality can be approached in different ways, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It can be approached in different ways. And has to be approached in all ways. Let's put it like that. Every aspect of existence that we have vantage, whether in mind, in life, body, has to be an approach to equality. That can be seen as one way of understanding the yoga itself.
Yeah, so this even this concentration can also lead to equality, meaning you see that it is actually an ignorance that makes inequality.
Yeah, absolutely.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Nick, would you like to read?
Overmind, then, gives us no final and positive solution. It is in a supramental cognition beyond it that we are left to seek for an answer. A supramental truth consciousness is at once the self-awareness of the infinite and eternal and a power of self-determination inherent in that self-awareness. The first is its foundation and status of being, the dynamis of its self-existence. All that a timeless eternity of self-awareness sees in itself as truth of being, the conscious power of its being manifests in time eternity. To supermind, therefore, the supreme is not a rigid indeterminable, an all-negating absolute, an infinite of being complete to itself in its own immutable purity of existence. Its sole power of pure consciousness able only to dwell on the being's changeless eternity, on the immobile delight of its sheer self-existence, is not the whole reality. The infinite of being must also be an infinite of power, containing in itself an eternal repose and quiescence. It must also be capable of an eternal action and creation. But this too must be an action in itself, a creation out of its own self, eternal and infinite, since there could be nothing else out of which it could create. Any basis of creation seeming to be other than itself must be still really in itself and of itself, and could not be something foreign to its existence. An infinite power cannot be solely a force resting in a pure and active sameness, an immutable quiescence. It must have in it endless powers of its being and energy. An infinite consciousness must hold within it endless truths of its own self-awareness. These in action would appear to our cognition as aspects of its being, to our spiritual sense as powers and movements of its dynamis, to our aesthesis as instruments and formulations of its delight of existence. Creation would then be a self-manifestation. It would be an ordered deploying of the infinite possibilities of the infinite. But every possibility implies a truth of being behind it, a reality in the existent. For without that supporting truth, there could not be any possibles. In manifestation, a fundamental reality of the existent would appear to our cognition as a fundamental spiritual aspect of the divine absolute. Out of it would emerge all its possible manifestations, its innate dynamisms. These again must create, or rather bring out of a non-manifest latency, their own significant forms, expressive powers, native processes. Their own being would develop their own becoming, svarupa, svabhava. This then would be the complete process of creation. But in our mind, we do not see the complete process. We see only possibilities that determine themselves into actualities. And though we infer or conjecture, we are not sure of a necessity, a predetermining truth, an imperative behind them, which capacitates the possibilities besides the actualities. Our mind is an observer of actuals, an inventor or discoverer of possibilities, but not a seer of the occult imperatives that necessitate the movements and forms of a creation. For in the front of universal existence, there are only forces determining results by some balance of the meeting of their powers. The original determinant or determinants, if it or they exist, are veiled from us by our ignorance. But to this supermental truth consciousness, these imperatives would be apparent, would be the very stuff of its seeing and experience. In the supermental creative process, the imperatives, the nexus of possibilities, the resultant actualities, would be a single whole, an indivisible movement. The possibilities and actualities would carry in themselves the inevitability of their originating imperative. All their results, all their creation would be the body of the truth which they manifest in predetermined significant forms and powers of the all existence.
So here he takes us to the supermind or the supramental cognition, which is the nature of what we have been calling the gnosis or the logos. And there he points out that it is the self-awareness and the power to manifest that self-awareness which coexist over there. So supramental truth consciousness is at once the self-awareness of the infinite and eternal, and a power of self-determination inherent in that self-awareness. So this is, in other words, the Creator, if you want to call it that, as part or an aspect of the being. In other words, the being can create itself. And that self-creation proceeds from a self-determination. Now, in that which is infinite can look at itself in infinite ways. And yet it can look at itself at one way, a single gaze which is infinite. So this single infinite way of looking at itself puts it in a certain kind of manifestation, orders it in a certain way, gives it a certain shape and form through which it appears, or presents itself. Now this self-presentation is taking place through the power of self-presentation. And that's what he's saying over here, that this self-awareness and the power of self-presentation belong to this being. And this infinite complex self-representation of all its truths is what supermind is carrying out. And that is also spawning itself as time. That is time, because all the possibilities are mapping themselves out in relations and explorations over eternity. Each possible order is what can be called a real idea. And this real idea is like a focus, a concentration, a tapas, you may say, that is working itself out as a formulation of the being. And therefore, that is represented as time, that is being as time. And hence, to our experience, we catch only a certain film of it, a certain surface of it, a surface which is only present, which has behind it the past, and which has in front of it the future. But the experience that we have is of a peculiar modality, where there is a certain immersion in time, and therefore that is the nature of the experience. But there are other kinds of experiences that being has at the same time, the highest of them being this one, where it perceives itself all at once in a single gaze, which gives it self-presentation.
I had a question. What I've been thinking about is how to learn this, how to practice this, how to come to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you could just do a preview. Does Shira Sri Aurobindo go there later in this reading?
Not in this particular chapter. He's preparing the ground for our, you know, sort of, as it were, orientation. This, how are we to orient ourselves? What is it that we are seeking for? And I think that itself is part of the practical. In other words, it prepares a concentrated focus. It gives us the idea on which we can meditate. It provides for us an aspiration towards which we can aspire. We can focus our energies. So from that point of view, these chapters are important practically. Apart from that, you know, how we can get there, that's sort of related to, you know, things like, I mean, sort of, you were present when we were, I gave that talk at CIF, where he provides certain methods for developing this bridge between the mind and the supermind, what he calls developing an intuitive consciousness. So that's, I mean, one way of looking at it. But I think what he's doing over here is to allow this idea to settle. And that's a very important and powerful tool in itself from a practical point of view, which resonates, as it were, in our depths and tunes our aspirations to the highest. Aspiration can be of a variety of kinds. You know, most people who enter into any yoga have some kind of aspiration. People who enter into the integral yoga all have some aspiration. Usually that aspiration is very amorphous. It's usually something which arises due to admiration. We are impressed or we admire the status of somebody like Sri Aurobindo or the mother. And hence we feel that if we could be a little like that, that's what kindles the aspiration. But aspiration has to become more and more concrete and detailed, and for that to happen, and also more and more high, it has to develop magnitude and height. And for that to happen, we need to have the fullness of the idea inside us. And that is partly what is happening over here.
Thank you.
Yeah, Vince.
I'm wondering, is that like what Sri Aurobindo talks about meditating, in all things may I see the divine?
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is the experience of Brahman. As he says, you know, what you're saying is quite true. That's one of the answers he gives to what is the best meditation. Somebody asks him once, what is the best meditation? He says the best meditation is the meditation on the idea that in all things there is the divine. Like, you know, all things are the Brahman. Sarvam Khalu Vidam Brahman, as the Upanishads say. But here, it's a little, it's not only that, that is certainly something which, if one can do that with eyes open, in other words, in a waking way, and arrive at the fullness of that realization, that is certainly equal to having this particular thing that he's talking about. But here what he's saying is that, you know, to understand that that particular experience, in all things may there is the Brahman, is a cogent, world-affirming experience in which the problem of knowledge is solved. In other words, we find that which knows itself. It's what they call the hermeneutic circle is completed. Because that is the one who knows himself. And that knowledge is the self-knowledge of the one in all things. So we may say that in all things there is the self-knowledge. You know, that's the kind of meditation he's talking about over here.
Now, can that meditation be an aspiration?
Yeah, absolutely. It is an aspiration. It is both an aspiration and a perception. So it is a will to perception, but it is an aspiration that leads us to that condition.
Thank you very much.
It's 9:29, but perhaps the verse that we can read one more paragraph and stop there and discuss the paragraph next time.
Okay, sure. Sounds good.
Lisa Elichman, would you like to read?
Sure, I'll give it a try. My internet connection is very bad, so I may be in and out, so please tell me if that's the case.
Sure.
Our fundamental cognition of the Absolute, our substantial spiritual existence of it, is the intuition or the direct experience of an infinite and eternal existence, an infinite and eternal consciousness, an infinite and eternal delight of existence. In overmental and mental cognition, it is possible to make discrete and even to separate this original unity into three self-existent aspects. For we can experience the pure causeless eternal bliss so intense that we are that alone, existence, consciousness, seem to be swallowed up in it, no longer ostensibly in presence. A similar experience of pure and absolute consciousness. And a similar exclusive identity with it is possible. And there can be, too, a like identifying experience of pure and absolute existence. But to a supermind cognition, these three are always an inseparable trinity, even though one can stand in front of the others and manifest its own spiritual determinants. For each has its primal aspects or is inherent self-formations, but all of these together are original to the dream absolute. Love, joy, and beauty are the fundamental determinants of the divine delight of existence. And we can see at once that these are of the very stuff and nature of that delight. They are not alien impositions on the being of the absolute, or creation supported by it, but outside it. They are truths of its being, native to its consciousness, powers of its force of existence. So too is it with the fundamental determinants of the absolute consciousness, knowledge, and will. They are truths and powers of the original consciousness force and are inherent in its very nature. This authenticity becomes still more evident when we regard the fundamental spiritual determinants of the absolute existence. They are its triune powers, necessary first postulates for all its self-creation or manifestation. Self, the divine, the conscious being, Atman, Ishvara, Purusha.
Okay, so I think we can revisit that next time. And here we see how Sri Aurobindo is looking at the primary ways through which this supramental consciousness self manifests, the primary properties of its existence, and what that implies and what that becomes in the becoming or as in time. But we can take that up next week.
Thank you.
Thank you, Debashish.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Yes.
Much to contemplate.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.